So today we want to talk about growing mushrooms, lion's mane mushrooms.
Yeah.
Why have you been growing lion's mane mushrooms?
Well, this might be a midlife crisis thing where you want to kind of grow stuff. I think that there's a satisfaction in a vegetable patch that I perhaps didn't appreciate 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But I do now. The idea of growing some food and then eating it, it's quite nice.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. Maybe we should start with what a lion's mane mushroom is. Just so you know, so that we know what we're talking about. So you've started growing lion's mane mushrooms.
I have, yeah.
In your house.
Yeah.
And you've got lots of fun kit that makes you look like a mad professor.
Yeah.
You said to me the other day that, you know, you now have a legitimate reason for owning a sort of, was it like a boiling flask or something?
Yeah, they have a name, I forget it.
Yeah. You know, it's a classic piece of chemistry, glassware.
Yeah.
It's very satisfying to
and
have
Petri
a legit,
dishes.
Yeah, legit reason to have
Bunsen
these things.
Burner and yeah.
Amazing. So, you know, what is a lion's mane mushroom? Why are they fun? Why are they important to grow or good to grow? And you know, what describe one?
So it is a mushroom. So mushrooms come in different types. And I think in the UK, we are extremely unadventurous when it comes to mushroom. If we think of a mushroom, we think of a button mushroom. Or chestnut mushroom, which is a sort of button mushroom. Or a portobello mushroom, which is a sort of button mushroom. They're all the same. They're all the same species.
And we call this mycophobia, don't we? So this is sort of Greek term, the myco mushroom and phobia.
Yeah,
fear.
I mean, there's quite a deep thing. A guy called R. Gordon Wasson, a banker in the US, was the one to notice this, that he married, I think she was Russian or Polish or something, and he was on a nice romantic walk with his wife through the forests in America one time, and there was a patch of mushrooms that he thought nothing of, and he saw his wife just dive on them with joy and collect them and then cook up in the evening. It's like, I would never have considered doing that, because to me, mushrooms are potentially dangerous and toxic. And that caused him to dedicate his life to learning more about mushrooms and their cultural implications. And yeah, he came to the conclusion that, yeah, some societies are mycophobic, and I think British is an example of that, where we just don't... We fear mushrooms. They're not...
We're sort of ambivalent about them, aren't we?
Yeah.
They're okay, as you say, in their sort of friendly button varieties. We'll buy them at the supermarket, but they're very sort of bland and unthreatening. Anything that's immediately off the beaten track is...
Yeah,
anything
yellow growing out of a tree. Yeah. We're like, I'm not touching that.
Yeah, yeah.
Whilst it's the exact opposite in Eastern Europe is a good example, or Russia, where they absolutely love mushrooms, and going and picking mushrooms and being good at identifying mushrooms and cooking mushrooms is a huge part of the culture. It's what one does in the autumn.
And so they would be, what, mycophiliac?
Yeah, I think that's what I call it. Yeah. And again, so this isn't just a European thing. I mean, in Southern Africa, they're very mycophilic. Because mushrooms tend to grow there just as the rains start. And so they provide a really important source of food when there is no other source of food, because this is just in the dry season.
Yeah.
You haven't been able to grow anything for months. You've just eaten all your food stores. And although it started raining, which means that plants will start growing again, it's going to be a couple of months before there's anything you can eat.
It's a sort of transitional food source.
Exactly, and that's exactly when the mushrooms sprout. And so, you know, it's very surprising if you go to somewhere like Zimbabwe, but they are much more adventurous around mushrooms than the Brits are. Like any standard supermarket, there'll be oysters, there'll be all sorts of gourmet mushrooms in a way that's really, really quite surprising. Yeah,
and we're not talking about, you know, obviously there are people in the UK who are, you know, massively into mushrooms and will go out and looking for them. And I think there's probably quite a few people, but we're talking about a sort of cultural average here, aren't we?
That's exactly
the point. Yeah.
And I think, yeah, they are a minority. It's really not a major thing going and picking mushrooms in the UK.
I mean, immediately that gets into the kind of fun discussion about how weird mushrooms are in general. I mean, is it worth touching on that in the UK and maybe in places like North America as well? I mean, we don't really think about mushrooms. They're sort of a thing that sits in their own category, but not much thought is spent on them. But when you actually look at mushrooms and you think about what they are, they're very weird and alien things. And I think there's been a lot of more focus recently on how weird and fun and cool they are, with a few interesting books coming out about, you know, the how they are the sort of the thing that interweaves between all different forms of sort of flora and
yeah, I mean,
and
they colonized the land before plants did.
Yeah.
So there was a time when the only life on land was these large fungal things.
Yeah, and they're not really plants, and they're not. But
they're closer to animals.
Yeah. And they've got these kind of three stages of life, don't they? There's the spore, the mycelium, and then the fruiting body.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, that what we think of as a mushroom is only a very small part of the organism. That's the fruiting body, you know, the seed pod, basically.
Yeah.
And the actual organism is this network of fibers under the ground or in the tree. And these can be enormous. So the biggest living thing is a large mushroom somewhere in North America, I think, that covers acres and acres.
And I think I remember reading that the mycelium is actually essential for example, tree roots being able to absorb nutrients. So the roots of trees have to be sheathed in mycelium in order to achieve certain chemical processes that feed the tree. So, you know, it is a really fundamental part of the incredibly complex web of biology that's going on under in the soil. Mm. And it's kind of everywhere. We don't see it, but it's essential and it's everywhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, you leave a petri dish out with some agar medium on it, and you know, if you leave the lid off for like 10 seconds and see what happens, you'll see that there are spores floating around everywhere all the time.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Cool. Maybe it's the mushrooms world and we're just guests, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an interesting thought. And I don't, you know, if you've ever been out mushroom picking, I have a few times because I, you know, have a vague interest. And sometimes you find an odd mushroom in an odd place. I remember that ink cap that you found when we went out, and it was in this sort of woody sort of dell, and there was sort of you pointed it out, and you look in, you looked under these dark, in the sort of dark forest floor, in this shady bunch of trees, and I remember it as there being sort of wisps of mist on the ground, and there was this magnificent massive ink cap just standing sort of solitary in the middle of this scene, and it had a sort of presence, you know, that I was obviously I was projecting onto it, but I felt it had this presence as a sort of very mysterious object that was in that setting, and it was really wonderful. A really wonderful thing.
Well, that presence, I mean, you're not alone in having felt it. So this R. Gordon Wasson guy who posited the culture that mycophobic or mycophilic, he was like, well, why would this happen? And there's only one case where societies are diametrically opposed on a question. That's because it's been part of religion. Mm. Like that's the only way you're going to get whole cultures with such a strong view on something random.
Yeah.
That the only way this could have happened is if they were seen as divine in some way, and then there was some sort of schism, and then half of the population thought they were demons and half thought they were gods or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's how you end up with one culture hating mushrooms and one loving mushrooms, is because at one point mushrooms were divine.
Yeah, it's easy to see how that could happen. I mean, there are sort of deep roots of that that are still sort of, you can just kind of glimpse them, I think. The notion of a fairy ring, which is a sort of when you get toadstools in a circle. You might have seen this in, say, I don't know, a Disney film or something like that.
Or in the real world.
In the real world, yeah. and the idea that this is a place of sort of power.
Yeah. And of course, yeah, the toadstools and gnomes are always kind of linked in the imagination.
Yes, they are, aren't they?
Or fairies or,
The little creatures live in toadstools, yes.
Yeah, and notably it's the red ones, which are hallucinogenic.
And then there's the stuff from South America as well. There are these incredible stone sculptures of mushrooms that crop up everywhere. In certain, is it Mesoamerica or South America? I'm not an expert on this, but
I think even in North America, in you know, around Washington State, you get various petroglyphs that are mushroom themed.
Obviously, mushrooms, you know, it does include the psychedelic hallucinogenic variety with sort of psilocybin, and it's very easy to see how one could ascribe religious power to those if, you know, if they produce the kind of experiences that they are said to produce. It's very, very easy to see how that could.
But at the same time, the fairy rings, they're not psychedelic mushrooms. The ink cap, whose presence you so admired in the forest, that was not a psychedelic mushroom. And again, I mean, you can also say, you know, a lot of the ones that aren't psychedelic have medicinal properties, you know, including lion's mane, which is said to be extremely good for neurons. And
well, there we go. Back to Lion Domain then. A slight wandering detour there, but I think a productive one. So
absolutely, yeah.
So like that's a bit of a background about you know how you think about mushrooms and why they're interesting and why they're cool. And so Lion's Mane. What's particularly interesting about Lion's Mane as a mushroom?
Well, the main thing is that they are tasty and quite straightforward to grow in the UK.
And they're supposed to have all of these sort of positive health properties.
Also that, yeah. So they're enormous mushrooms. So they'll be half a kilo or something like that. Maybe big round things covered in hairs. And you can slice them up and fry them and they're very nice. But yeah, also they're said to have amazing benefits for the brain. Almost a nootropic. And you get a whole load of those nootropic supplements that are lion's mane based, so you can take lion's mane supplements, lion's mane capsules, or you'll find lion's mane, you know, dried and powdered as an important ingredient in those like Athletic Greens and expensive hype supplements.
And do you know what the actual specific sort of compounds or chemicals in the lion's mane are, or is that not particularly important? Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, just take that one on faith. I mean, yeah. You know how robust these claims are, I'm not sure.
You're not doing it just because you are, you know, into hype supplementation.
No, although I'll take a 5% reduction in my odds of getting dementia.
I'll take that as well. Yeah, it's worth a try. And as you say, they're tasty and they're fun to grow. So what's they're easy to grow, they're fun to grow, they taste nice. What is it, if you were to reflect on, you know, what has changed over the last 10 years that now allows you to appreciate the beauty or the enjoyable, the satisfaction of growing something? What would your reflections be on that?
I think a lot of it is dealing with the real world. I think so much of our jobs now are quite abstract, and so much of our hobbies and entertainment is pretty abstract, that there's something about actually putting your wits against reality, about dealing with the real world, that is compelling. So even if it's in quite a low-stakes way, like growing some potatoes, you know, you went out into nature and did that thing. You got your hands dirty. I think that is a driving force.
Yeah.
In that I do feel detached from the land.
Yeah. Oh, I think we've got a slight interruption in proceedings as a toddler rampages in. Okay, should we pause there?
Let's pause there.
Advertising break.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, welcome back, everybody, after a very short intermission.
Sadly, we had nothing to advertise, but...
We were discussing the process of growing lion's mane. Are you pitting yourself against nature, a sort of a lone hero out in the wild, discovering things?
Yeah, I mean... Let's talk about the results first. So you've just eaten some of my lion's mane mushrooms.
I have.
How was it?
It was lovely. And as I commented to you at the time, if I close, it's quite meaty. If I closed my eyes and you know was thinking mostly about something else, I could imagine myself thinking it was sort of chicken or something like that. Well, when you're paying attention to it, it doesn't taste like chicken, and the texture is subtly different, of course. But it's got that kind of depth of flavour. It's got that kind of firm texture. It's Moorish. It's tasty. It feels it tastes as if it's kind of got nutrition in it. It's kind of got that depth, which is very lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a rich flavour and fibrous. So it kind of feels satisfying to eat.
Yeah.
In a way that butter mushrooms do not.
Yeah, I would agree. It's not slimy at all.
Yeah.
So sometimes mushrooms can come across a little bit slimy, but no, not at all.
Well, that's partly credit to my wife for cooking it. I think you have to be quite careful to make sure you've fry it in quite a dry way.
Okay.
Because, yeah, these can become even slimier, I think, than normal mushrooms if you're not careful.
There's something to be said for sliminess, but I know that some people that don't like mushrooms, they don't like them for that reason.
Yeah, that's a skill issue.
Yeah. Fair enough. Now, in your kitchen, you have got all of this fantastic kit, as we alluded to earlier, before the intermission. How has that been, being able to buy all of this kit? We talked about the amazing flasks and petri dishes you have, but now you have these sort of greenhouse structures. You have a You have a sort of a mobile lab made out of plastic sheeting with the sort of the armholes as if it's, you know, in one of those cheesy movies. And you have, you know, spraying equipment and humidifiers and things going beep and fans and LCD displays of various sort of metrics like humidity and all of this. And it's extremely exciting.
The sad truth is that the difference between like being a hobbyist growing one or two mushrooms and a small commercial operation, there is basically no difference.
Right.
It's the same kit.
Right.
And probably to explain it and to explain my very interesting Amazon order history, I should probably go through the whole process.
Please do. Yeah. This is what we want. We want to go through the process. So are we missing anything out before we go? I don't think we are. We've explained what Lion's Mane Mushroom is. We've explained why you would want to grow it. We've explained sort of the basic thing that made you interested in it, which was wanting to sort of grapple with nature like some kind of, you know, modern day Hercules.
How it tastes.
Yeah, how it tastes. So take us through. What did you have to do to get to the point where you are producing these fantastic Lion's Mane mushrooms?
The first time I ever grew a mushroom, it was with a grow kit. So you can buy online. It's basically a box that has some material like sawdust or whatever that already has the mycelium culture in it. Hmm. And you just put it somewhere, you know, read the instructions. Almost you'd be around humidity. And then a few weeks later, you'll have a mushroom. And I'd always recommend someone starts there. But that is quite expensive and not very satisfying. It's a bit like growing, you know, those watercress things where you just add water and then you get cress and it's like, great.
Yeah, so there's only really one variable for you to manage.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as long as you're paying attention and you put a little bit of effort into it, it'll happen.
Yeah, but it's also like 20 quid for one of these boxes and I'm not paying that every time I want to. No. A Lion's Mane mushroom. And again, this is one of the reasons why we don't eat many exotic mushrooms in the UK is because it's really expensive. Mm. But it's good to do that first to kind of understand what you're dealing with, because mushrooms are very different to plants. As we said, they're close to animals and plants. And actually, I recently bought another book on mushroom cultivation. I have a whole shelf full of them now. Mm. And one of the first things it says is, remember, mushrooms are not plants. Don't treat them like plants. You'll just be disappointed.
Right. Yeah.
I find them more like a kind of slow motion ant farm in how they behave.
Right. So the mycelium are like the sort of the different ants, the different strands of the mycelium.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it keeps escaping or trying to. So if you want to do more than that, you've got two starting points. One is you buy what's called liquid culture, which is basically so some sort of strings of mycelium in liquid. So it'd be in some water with nutrients in it, and you buy it in a syringe.
I think I've just had a flash of inspiration about what you should call your first rum that you make. You should call it liquid culture.
Ooh.
That'd be good, wouldn't it? That'd be lol. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted. Carry on. Yeah, so you liquid culture, you do this stuff with it. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe your advertising break should be my as yet to begin rum brand.
Yeah.
You heard it here first. and so that, it's sterile in a syringe. And so it's quite easy to deal with. And what you have to do first is... So first you need to create what's called spawn, which is the kind of base amount of mycelium that will be strong enough to then colonize the fruiting medium. I realize I'm dropping a lot of technical terms in here.
Well, let's take it step by step. Okay, so you've got your liquid culture,
yeah.
And it's sterile in a syringe. And yeah. In the liquid culture, just remind me again, sorry. So what is there of the mushroom in this liquid culture?
It's strings of mycelium. So someone has grown a mushroom culture, so they've got a bunch of mycelium, and then they've
got that from the spores.
Yeah. So you start with spores.
Yeah.
They fuse or whatever, and then start growing a network of mycelium.
So the spores fuse together,
yeah,
and that allows them to start forming these strands, which are called mycelium. And they're like, it's like, it looks a little bit like mold, or
well, it is mold in a
way. As in the mold you might experience on your bread, yeah. or sort of, you know, dense cobwebs.
So what do you see in your damp cellar or in your food bin after a week.
Yeah, or my cupboard in my personal case.
It actually looks pretty disgusting. And one of the interesting things I found with this, I've lost my disgust reflex to mold.
Okay.
Because I now see it for what it is, which is just a network of mycelium, rather than some kind of toxic danger thing.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. Because now, you know, I've got pots full of mycelium that is good and that I want to encourage.
So that goes back to our discussion about mycophilia and mycophobia.
Yeah, you just need to know the mushroom and then you're like...
Know the mushroom. Yeah. We're getting names for everything. That's our first album. Know the mushroom. Sorry, yeah, carry on. Yeah.
These grow out. And you're growing them out in a Petri dish.
Yeah.
So the other way of starting... So I said, you know, the basic way of starting is you buy a syringe full of this liquid culture.
Yeah.
The more advanced level, which is what I've been doing more recently, is you buy spores. So you basically buy a spore print where someone's put a mature mushroom, you know, so the fruiting body, on some silver foil or something like that. It's dumped all those spores on it.
Mm.
And then you have that. And these spores will last ages, you know, years. And then you transfer some of these spores onto an agar plate. So into a Petri dish into which you've put agar medium, which is... I think agar is an extract from some sort of seaweed, but it creates this jelly. And you add some nutrients to that mix as well. So you end up with a whole Petri dish with this nutrient-dense jelly. And you put the spores onto this jelly.
Mm-hmm.
There's a delicate art to it, because, again, you need to keep it all this sterile.
Yeah, that's the trick, isn't it? You can't allow spores from any other mushrooms that are just in the environment to get in the way.
You've made a whole of a spore food, but you only want the spores you want to to eat it. So you're doing this in... If you are rich or commercial, you're doing this in front of a heaper air filter that's kind of blowing purified air towards you.
Yeah, HEEP is an acronym, isn't it, that stands for something or
other. Yeah. I forget what it is, but it's a filter that takes out tiny particles from the air. So there's basically just nothing in the air that's being blown, so there's nothing that can land in your Petri dish or anywhere else. And this sterile air is blowing away all the air that's around us that's full of spores.
Mm.
So that's the expensive way. I do the slightly cheaper way, which is called a still air box, which is this... it's a box, in my case, made of sort of flexible plastic sheeting.
Yep.
And it's got two holes for your arms that you put in, and then everything you're doing is within this box. Mm. The idea is that it's not a sterile environment, but because the air is still, you're not going to get as many spores floating into your stuff.
Yeah, so it's a kind of controlled environment, not sterile.
There's still some risk, so you've still got to be very quick and precise in how you work.
Mm.
Because if you keep the lid off your Petri dish for the longer you do it for, the higher the risk is that some mold will grow in it.
And what are we talking about here? Are we talking about you sort of using a knife to sort of scrape the spores off the foil into this Petri
almost.
Dish?
So there's a thing called an inoculation loop. So it's a little loop of wire with a handle. And you first sterilize that in a flame. And then you scoop up some spores in it, and then you kind of wave this loop across the surface of the agar.
Right.
And
you have to do this in a matter of seconds, or does it have to be
extremely
done?
Quick? Yeah, right, okay. It should be quick and precise.
Okay.
Because you want the lid off the Petri dish for as short a time as possible.
Right.
And then there's some practice to this, because you want a certain density of the spores, because you want two spores to meet and fall in love and have mycelium babies. But if it's too dense, then there's much more risk of infection.
Okay.
Because these spores, they're not sterile. It's mostly spores, but there'll be some other stuff in there as well because it was done in an environment.
And we're talking about bacteria here, presumably, rather than other mushrooms.
It could be bacteria. It could be just the fungal spores that are all around us, all the mold spores and things
right,
like that.
Right, okay. Okay.
Reasonably unlikely if it's been done properly. But you can also clone wild mushrooms in a similar way. You can cut a bit off a mushroom and put it on a Petri dish.
Right.
And in that case, there's going to be all sorts of stuff on it.
This is one of the interesting elements that perhaps we could get into in a bit, which is this isn't sexual reproduction. This is cloning, isn't it, when mushrooms spore?
No, so
if you're working from spores, that is actually sexual reproduction. Oh, right. You get two spores that fuse and create mycelium.
So they're coming from two different fruiting bodies, or am I misunderstanding?
No, they're coming from the same fruiting body.
Right.
But I think the spores are genetically different in some way.
I mean, that's one of the other fascinatingly weird things about a mushroom, then, that it's kind of, it's both sexes in a single organism.
Yeah. I haven't thought about this too much.
Okay.
But but straight up cloning is what you're doing all the rest of the time. So you can take a wild mushroom, cut a bit off it, put it in an agar medium, and it will grow out more mycelium. And that is cloning.
Right.
And if you are buying liquid culture, that is a syringe of the same organism. And so you'll be growing many mushrooms from this spore because you'll grow out the mycelium, split it up.
Yeah. But when you're going from the spores themselves, that's a slightly different thing where it's a sexual reproduction.
Exactly. And that's where it gets interesting because you're not going to get exactly the same strain as the parent mushroom.
Right.
When you are cloning, which is using liquid culture or cutting a bit of a mushroom and growing it out, that is cloning.
Right.
And you'll get exactly the same strain. Mm. And a good strain is a precious thing. Like people spend a lot of time trying to make the perfect strain.
Right.
And sell them commercially. And yeah, the genetics is a big thing because if you keep using the same mycelium again and again and again and keep growing it out and then splitting it and growing it out, it will eventually get old. It gets senescent.
Right.
And less vigorous.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
And so there's only so many times you can clone.
Is that an epigenetic effect?
What does that mean?
It means that where the interaction of the genes with the world changes the genes.
I think it is aging.
Not changes the genes, but it changes the things that are switched on and the things that are switched off within the genetic code.
The most interesting insight there is that one of the ways of staving off senescence in your strain. So the idea is you have a strain in a sort of dish in your fridge or in a slant, it's called, so in a test tube. And then you grow it out. And every time you do that, you're increasing the kind of age and so reducing the potency of your strain. But if you grow it out each time on a different nutrient base, so you put different nutrients in your agar medium.
Right.
So one time you use like malt extract, one time you use some other sugar.
Yeah.
Or like potato or something like that. If you keep changing the environment you're growing it out in and the nutrients you're feeding it, that actually staves off senescence.
So that's really interesting.
You keep giving it new experiences.
That's the sort of thing that makes me interested in biology. There was so little that made me interested in biology at school, I remember. But, that is fascinating, and I'd love to know more about it.
Yeah, exactly. But also, I mean, the analogy to humans, like, I think the thing that does keep you vigorous is forcing yourself to have new experiences all the time.
We talked about that in our episode on hobbies, didn't we?
We did indeed.
Yeah. So there's a little plug for that episode if you're interested in that.
Yeah.
So sorry, where did we get to in terms of the process then? We've talked about what is going on when you've either got a liquid culture or you're going from spores, and we've kind of dug into that. So you personally, were you going from liquid culture and you put it onto an agar?
The first time, If I talk through the spore process, is how you end up with liquid culture.
Okay.
So the spores grow out in mycelium.
Mm-hmm.
You generally want to then run them out through a couple of different dishes to make sure you've isolated a pure strain. So what you do there is, well, once the mycelium has covered the whole Petri dish, it's grown out, you've made sure there are no molds or bacteria you don't want on that Petri dish.
Yeah.
And then with a scalpel, again, under sanitized conditions, you cut out a square of this.
Yeah.
And put it in a new Petri dish. And then that grows out as well. And then you can do that a couple of times if you want. But it's all about reducing risk at this point.
Yeah.
But then you can take that Petri dish and you slice it up into little squares. And you can put it into a pot of sterilized grain.
Okay.
So to sterilize this grain, what I do is you get a kind of mason jar.
Mm-hmm.
Fit it with... But so you get some some rye grain,
okay,
whole grain. You soak it overnight
in water.
Yeah,
sterile water, presumably.
Filtered water, I think.
Okay,
just because it doesn't need to be sterile at this point because you're sterilizing later.
Right.
but you don't want there to be some chlorine and things in it.
Okay.
Because that will then be in your mushrooms.
Yep.
And mushrooms are quite good at picking up, you know, the elements around it.
Okay.
So if you're growing them in slightly polluted environments,
unsalubrious circumstances.
So that, you know, picking mushrooms from next to a road, for example, is inadvisable because they'll have incorporated a lot of the sort of heavy metals and stuff. So, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I use filtered water, soak it overnight. Then you boil it for maybe a quarter of an hour, half an hour.
And that's the grain.
So you're boiling the grain in water.
Yeah.
Then you sieve it out. And so the idea is that the grain is now saturated with water, which is what you want. You don't want too much water or the mycelium, you know, drowns or whatever. It doesn't like it. But you need a lot of water in there, as much as the grain can naturally hold.
Yep.
Then you put that in mason jars, and then you put that in a pressure cooker. So now you're sterilizing it. So until then, it was not sterile.
Mm.
So it was full of all sorts of bacteria and mold.
Mm-hmm.
You put it in a pressure cooker and cook it quite hot for an hour or two.
Yep.
Now it's sterile, sealed in a mason jar.
And the mason jar is so that it's to keep it sterile because it's sealed. And presumably it's also to stop the water escaping as you heat it up.
Yeah.
Right.
That's not quite true. You don't seal it when it's in the pressure cooker.
Okay.
Because I think the pressure differential can get
a bit
much.
Explode your jar.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
But the interior of the pressure cooker is sterile until you open it. And so long as you're very careful with the mason jars in that period between opening the pressure cooker and screwing them down firmly, you're okay. And you can mitigate that a bit by putting kitchen foil on top. So there's it's not zero opportunity for mold to get in, but it's very, very low. I haven't had one get infected yet.
Okay.
So that now you have sterile grain.
Okay.
And mycelium likes this very much. A lot of nutrients. And so you then inject your syringe of spawn of liquid culture into this grain.
Or you put your little cubes
or
of
you,
agar.
You open it up quickly and put the cubes in it.
Yeah.
And then now you leave that for a couple of weeks, shaking it every couple of days, and the mycelium grows out throughout the grain. And then you have what is called grain spawn.
Okay.
So that is grain that's just covered in mycelium.
Yep.
Covered in vigorous, happy mycelium.
Yep.
The problem with grain is it's quite expensive. And to give the mushrooms the amount of nutrients it wants, it'd be quite a lot of grain. But also because it's so nutritious, the chance of interlopers getting in and then out-competing your mushroom gets quite high.
Okay.
So actually you want to put into the kind of least nutritious thing that your mushroom species would
can
want.
Handle, yeah.
So you grow it into the grain, and you can also do, if you need more grain spawn, because the ratio of grain to what you're then putting into next needs to be above a certain amount.
Okay.
You could keep just putting half that grain into a new pot of grain, and then that grows out. And so you can kind of keep doubling or tripling or whatever.
Okay, yeah.
So you can have basically infinite grain spawn by that point.
Yep.
And then, so you can turn this grain spawn into liquid culture just by putting in some distilled water and grinding it.
Yeah.
Basically putting it in a kind of sterile food blender, and then you have liquid culture.
Okay, so that's how, that's the stage you're cutting out by just buying the liquid culture.
You then have this grain spawn. Now you want to put it into your fruiting medium. For lion's mane, lion's mane is a mushroom that grows on trees. So you want to kind of simulate the feeling of being in a tree.
Mm.
So sawdust is what you tend to use.
Okay.
I buy hardwood pellets, the sort of thing you use for pizza ovens and stuff like that. Very cheaply available in large quantities on Amazon. You can buy a 10-kilo bag.
One of the things I find really interesting about this is that how does the mushroom in air quotations know? I mean, I suppose that it's the chemical, you know, the mushroom is bringing in chemicals across its sort of boundaries, isn't it? In order to nourish itself, and presumably the precise combinations of chemicals signal or cause to happen the various things that you want to happen. And so if it gets the right chemicals that you would get from a tree, then that's its signal that everything's good and it can go ahead and fruit.
So, I mean, you're also just feeding it the stuff it needs to eat. It's like you feed a horse certain things if you want it to, you know, they can't, I mean, digest is probably the wrong word, but if you give them softwood sawdust, it doesn't work at all.
Right.
So it is more like this is their food.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
We're not yet simulating the fruiting itself. So what we need now is this bulk medium. You want the mycelium to grow out through this. So you've got a lot of bulk, and that bulk then gets converted into the fruiting body.
Okay.
So I tend to have bags of, a couple of kilos of sawdust. And I also add soy husks, which, again, you can buy pelletized from animal feed suppliers.
Okay.
So 50-50, these hardwood pellets and soy husks, and then you add some filtered water. Mm. Put it on a bag, and then sterilize that bag in the pressure cooker again.
Yeah.
So then you have a sealed bag full of sterilized, moist sawdust and soy husks. Mm-hmm. Soy husks add extra nutrients, nitrates or something like that, that are not necessary, but they make the mushrooms grow bigger and faster.
Mm. Okay. It's like fertilizer.
Yeah, this mix is called Master's Mix, and like some guy found it about 20 years ago. And you have a whole lot of people just constantly experimenting with stuff. The whole art of growing these things commercially in artificial environments is very young. So people are finding new optimizations all the time.
That's one of the interesting things about it, isn't it? It's infinitely kind of complex. So it's something, a process that has this many stages and that is involved with organisms and biology. I mean, it's the complexity is quite wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah. And once you become a master at it, then you can start experimenting yourself. I'm still very much following recipes that I read on Reddit. But once you just get the hang of it and get a feel for it, then everyone experiments. It's very much part of the culture of growing your own mushrooms. It is this DIY mentality and you're just trying stuff.
Yeah. Very rich and rewarding. Because, I mean, presumably when you have the experience of trying something and it, you know, maybe it doesn't completely fail or it does work and you've discovered something new about the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, possibly nobody else knows that thing.
Exactly. And then also, I mean, developing your own strains, like, you create a new strain of lion's mane that is actually far more commercially valuable than the current standard strains.
Yeah, very cool.
It might colonize more robustly or give bigger fruit or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's something that happens. And again, in the culture of mushroom cultivators, there's a whole thing about sort of swapping strains with each other. And it's almost like swapping records back in the 70s, helping each other build out their library of genetic material.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, you know, it's like many different what you might call hobbies, where there's enough complexity that you can experiment and you can explore and you can interact with others in order to explore the complexity and all of that kind of thing. But if you're talking about, I don't know, like sort of stamp collecting or something like that, it's quite sterile. You know, that you don't have the unpredictability of biology going on in there, the creative element.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not complex as well. I mean, yes, stamps are complicated. There's lots of knowledge.
Yeah.
But, well, mushrooms, it's more the interaction of just millions of very simple systems.
Yeah.
And that creates, these emergent properties that are far, far more weird and unexpected than under a kind of, human-created system.
Is that kind of chaotic element what you might think of as the element of chance within a game that keeps a game interesting? But, of course, here the chaotic chance element is life itself, which is very cool.
Yeah, and there's also jeopardy, because if you do get infected, then you have to write off a whole crop.
Yeah.
There's some danger as well.
Is it a crop or is it a brood?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, so and then you've got your bulk medium, you've got your grain spawn or your mycelium from the grain spawn in your bulk medium.
So you pour that into the bag, shake it up, seal the bag, leave it for a couple of weeks, somewhere cool and dark, and then the mycelium is again colonizing the sawdust. And then when you see that it's fully colonized, which is quite subtle with lion's mane, the mycelium is less obvious than in oyster mushrooms. But yeah, the bags become firm and a slightly lighter color.
Okay.
You then put it into your fruiting chamber.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's an exciting thing. A fruiting chamber.
Yeah. And so this is the thing that dominates my kitchen. It's basically a very cheap. You can buy these mini greenhouses on Amazon.
Mm.
There's basically just a kind of see-through plastic tent on top of a frame that has some shelves.
Yep.
And so this isn't to keep it sterile so much, although it does help keep the environment a bit cleaner. But it's to create the atmosphere you want.
Which is basically that of the sort of the forest floor in October.
Exactly, yeah. You're trying to simulate the environment that these mushrooms like to grow in.
Yeah.
And so that means, firstly, there's temperature. Happily, lion's mane are happy at basic room temperature.
Yeah.
So you don't need to worry too much about heat mats and stuff if you're doing it literally in your house.
Mm.
If you're doing it in a shed, then you would need to heat it a bit in winter.
Yeah.
Or cool it a bit in summer.
Mm.
The other two variables are humidity.
Yep.
So you want an environment that's kept at about 80% humidity.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, then, I just got a cheap humidifier from Amazon.
Yep.
That's in the bottom of this tent. And it's hooked up to a humidity controller, which is actually the most expensive bit of this whole setup.
Mm.
It's £30-40. And it's basically a socket. You plug into the wall, and then it's got a sensor that goes into this tent.
Mm.
And whenever the humidity goes below 80%, it turns the socket on.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever it goes above 80%, it turns it off, basically.
Yeah. So it's a switch, basically.
It's a switch,
yeah.
Controlled by humidity levels.
Yeah.
And so the humidifier is plugged into this. So when the humidity goes below a certain threshold, the humidifier is turned on.
Yep.
When it goes above, it's turned off.
Yep.
So all quite simple.
Yeah.
But then now I have a tent that's got 80% humidity in it.
Mm.
The final step is, it's called fresh air exchange. Mushrooms release a lot of carbon dioxide when they're growing.
Mm.
But they don't like being in a carbon dioxide-rich environment. So you have to actually flush the air out quite regularly.
They're a bit like us in that respect.
Yeah, we don't like too much carbon dioxide either. Mm. And so you cut a hole in the top of the tent and put a fan in that. And then I have that fan attached to a timer so that every hour for a couple of minutes, it blows the carbon dioxide out and sucks it in.
Mm.
And then sucks in fresh air.
Yeah.
That's got a filter over it, because otherwise you're going to fill your kitchen with spores and that gets quite hazardous.
Yeah.
And if you see the commercial operations, if you ever go into the fruiting room, people are wearing all these face masks.
It gets hazardous for your health?
Yeah.
Yeah, as in like spores get into your lungs.
Yeah, it's like literally billions of spores will be in the environment and it'll get into your lungs and be horrible. Yeah.
Yeah.
In that quantity. As I say, there are spores all around us all the time, but not many.
Yeah.
But each mushroom produces millions of spores.
Mm.
And so if you've got a whole room full of them.
That's bad news.
Yeah. So actually, watching an episode of Clarkson's Farm the other day, at son's behest. It was a classic thing. Oh, you grow mushrooms. Jeremy Clarkson also grew mushrooms. You must watch the episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, so watching is like, yep, that's him growing, well, or his team growing mushrooms.
Yeah.
Not sure how much credit he himself can.
Yeah.
But when he goes into his underground bunker that is his fruiting room,
yeah,
everyone just puts on masks.
Yeah. Modern sense is that Jeremy Clarkson's lungs would not stand up well to.
Yeah, they've been through a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, so now you've got this chamber that has reasonably fresh air that gets cycled out. Humidity is kept at a certain level, and it's at a good temperature. So then you cut a hole in your bag of sawdust, and that fresh air and humidity is the signal for the mycelium to start fruiting. And so it normally takes a week or so to realize what's happening.
Yeah.
And then you suddenly see all this, the medium around the hole gets like bright white with mycelium as it kind of clusters in.
Yeah.
And you can almost see the kind of tendrils kind of pulling nutrients towards this one point. And then it starts growing the mushroom, the fruiting body.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
how does it coordinate? And you know, we're so biased as the type of organism we are to have this kind of model of centralized command from the brain that then sort of sends commands down to everywhere else, and we can kind of understand that. But when it's distributed across a sort of a network like mycelium, there's no brain. You know, how does it coordinate into that one particular point? I mean, it's uncanny.
It's really strange.
It's
to
alien,
watch. And it gets even worse as well because what the pros do is they use a heat sealer to seal up these bags.
You have one.
I just got one. It arrived this morning. From Amazon.
Yeah.
Because I was not sealing the bags properly. I was kind of folding them over a few times and then taping them shut.
Mm.
And the mycelium keeps escaping through the top, which is actually really hard because these bags are quite long. And so I folded over like 8 times, then taped it hard down. That's an airtight seal.
Yeah.
But somehow the mycelium knows that there's an opening there.
Yeah.
And it forces its way through. And so I have these mushrooms kind of escaping from the top of the bag, which not what I want at all.
Yeah. But then again, you know, these things are, you know, they've adapted to live in a forest where you have to push your way through wood and organic matter, and you know, you're constantly fighting for space and with other things. And
it's fighting really hard.
Yeah.
And it almost prefers this to the nice hole I cut for it.
Yeah. Very strange.
Mm.
Very strange. And the fruiting process itself is a bit uncanny and weird as well, isn't it? Because the mushrooms, but you might think that a mushroom sort of grows like a plant, you know, quite slowly. But it doesn't, does it? It fruits very rapidly.
They grow very quickly. Yeah.
The what we think of as a mushroom can appear overnight, can't it? It kind of goes whoop. And there it is.
Yeah. I mean, these ones, obviously, they're quite big. They do take a week or two to go from, you know, a little nodule to you know, the final half kilo or kilo.
Yeah, so these, with the lion's mane, if you're thinking of a sort of a mushroom with a stem and a cap, that's not what a lion's mane looks like at all. It's more like it looks a little bit more like something you would see on a coral reef. It looks like a bleached sort of coral.
Well, yeah, the coral, you're kind of giving it away a bit there because they shouldn't look like that.
Well, I mean, even the one that you said that looked more with the hairs, to me that looks like something you'd see on a coral reef.
Yeah, that's fair, yeah.
You know, there are different types of coral, and it's a particular type of coral, one with lots of sort of, I don't know, what do you call them? Like dendrils or, you know, it's like hairs.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of thin protuberances bunched up together, all, you know, heading out in different directions. So, yeah, that's, of course, why it's called the lion's mane, isn't it? It's the mane of hair. Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah. So it doesn't look like a mushroom with a stem and a cap at all.
No. It's a weird hairy growth coming out of the tree.
A weird hairy growth.
No, so my first one did look more like standard coral, and apparently that was because A, I had it too humid, and B, not enough fresh air was being drawn in.
Okay.
So there's been a long process of dialing in, and then I sort of overcorrected a bit from that, and then also it's been Christmas and stuff, so the kitchen's been quite cold, so it's been slightly below their optimal temperature, so they grow a bit smaller.
Yeah, it's Christmas's fault, that is.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm still dialing in. I haven't yet produced the perfect lion's mane, but I'm getting close.
But yeah, I mean, you are getting close. Mm. And, you know, we had some this morning, it was delicious.
And they still taste good.
And, you know, what you've achieved is very impressive. a lot of patience and, you know, I'm sure you can, any listener will realise from listening to that, there's this very technical, with quite small margins for error. In fact, almost razor thin margins for error.
Yeah, exactly. Protecting it from getting contaminated is the absolute battle, and that's where all the kind of weirdness comes from.
Yeah, you need the patience and the precision.
And then again, look, as I've said before, what you're creating is the perfect food for any bacteria or fungi. But you only want the one you want to grow on it.
Yeah.
And so to make sure that nothing else that's around us grows on it is really hard,
and everything that you're trying to fight against is not visible to the naked eye.
Yeah.
Obviously, so that makes it difficult as well, of course. you are dealing, you're blind basically in, yeah. in what you're doing. You're having
yeah,
to
fighting an invisible enemy.
You've got an invisible enemy. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Really, really, really cool and really interesting. So welcome back, everybody. After our second commercial break for this.
It's short to understand.
Yeah,
wasn't 2 months.
Yeah. Very good. So, you've at least mooted the possibility in the past of a more commercial operation about, you know, in growing mushrooms is a possibility in the future, and there's some history of that in your extended family. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, my wife grew up on a mushroom farm in Zimbabwe.
Mm.
Yeah, the plan would be to move out there at some time. And it's good to have the option to know that this is something I could do. It's become very difficult to grow mushrooms commercially in Zimbabwe because you can't get a hold of spawn. So normally if you're running a commercial operation, you're often buying the spawn from a specialist laboratory.
Yeah.
That handles all the genetics and grows out into the spawn. And then all you're doing is taking the spawn and putting it into the fruiting medium.
Yep.
And then growing that out in big sheds.
Yep.
You cannot buy this spawn in Zimbabwe anymore.
Mm.
There aren't many microbiologists or people with the technical expertise to handle the process.
Mm.
And you've got no electricity.
Mm.
Which matters a bit more there because you do need to keep things cool.
Yep.
Yeah, it's quite nice to know I have the skills to address most of those challenges.
Yeah.
Like, give me a spore print and I could actually run a large commercial operation, I think. As I said, the moves are the same for something in my kitchen and a large commercial operation.
Yeah, and it's an interesting sort of wider point about enterprise and businesses and so forth, isn't it? That you want to do something on a large scale. It really helps if you know how to do it on a small and individual artisanal sort of craftsman scale first.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's necessary, but if you are trying to do something in more of a frontier market,
yeah,
it helps to have a really good feel for the whole process and how it all behaves, because you're often going to have to be solving problems and working stuff out from first principles.
Right, okay.
And so if all you can do is follow a recipe,
yeah,
you're going to have to improvise at some point. And if you don't have a really good knowledge of the fundamentals and as you say, hands-on artisanal experience, you will struggle if something goes a bit off script.
It's an interesting insight into an economy in general, in that there are obviously what you call frontier economies, where you have to be prepared to improvise and you have to be prepared to work from first principles because there isn't the surrounding, what would you call it, commercial infrastructure or knowledge base to support somebody who doesn't have that knowledge base has to be present in its entirety within the individual, because you can't simply outsource that to the rest of the economy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, both the knowledge base and also the always the equipment. Like the difference between a factory in England and a factory in Kenya or somewhere is that factory in England, you've got all these machines.
Mm.
If one of them breaks, you call the repair guy who comes in, he'll get the spare part, replace it, and then you're up and running again.
Yeah.
In Kenya, that's not an option. That no one has all the spare parts in the country.
Mm.
There's no repair shop you can call who'll come around with the right bit and fix it. And so the same factory in Kenya also has a little shed in the corner full of engineers who will make the part from scratch when you need a replacement part. And they will install it. And so they have absolute mastery of the entire process. They know every machine in that room backwards.
Yeah.
And can create the spare parts themselves.
Mm.
And that means they are far more robust, because they need to be.
But there is a cost you pay in terms of price efficiency.
Oh, it
there?
Is far less efficient. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's much, if you have the supply chain in place.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Just buying the spare part in it is a lot cheaper. Assuming everything works. And what one of the worries about the modern economy is if the supply chain does start to fall apart, we're left helpless because nothing is self-sufficient.
Yeah.
Everything is relying on this huge network of logistics and other companies and experts. And if one link in that chain fails, the whole thing grinds to a halt.
It's the, one of the risks of hyper-specialization, isn't it?
Yeah, and globalization and these big supply chains.
So hyper-specialization allows you to be incredibly efficient. Mm. But yes, there is this problem of resilience.
Yeah.
Because for obvious reasons, if you don't have all of the knowledge, expertise, know-how to replicate something in one place, if some of that is overseas, and suddenly those overseas locations become inaccessible, then you're left with half the recipe and no product.
Exactly. And even just a small disruption, like at that time a cargo ship got stuck in the Suez Canal,
yeah,
and just delayed all shipping by a couple of weeks. That really hurt a lot of businesses, because
yeah,
you just need that stuff coming in.
Yeah, all the time.
There's no backup.
Yeah, definitely. So it's a very interesting insight, because there are, of course, frontier markets like you've described in, say, Zimbabwe or, as you say, Kenya. But there are also frontier parts of the economy, aren't there? When there's something new that's being invented, you know, a new product, or a new process or a new service, then you are on a sort of a different sort of frontier, aren't you? So if you're a startup that's doing something new, quite often you will have in the small group of people that are partaking in that, you will have the entire knowledge base that you need. Is that fair, or am I underestimating the just how dispersed the knowledge and expertise is in a modern economy?
It depends. I mean, your classic modern Western tech startup,
yeah,
is, you'll have seen some process that will be improved, and you are creating some software to address that.
Right.
And the idea is that you're going to be saving your customers enough through improving this process that, you know, you can share in the savings and they'll pay you some of that.
Mm. I suppose that the thing that I think about with this is the technology du jour, which is AI.
Mm.
You know, say that you're a chap, you're in London, and you want to create a new AI startup. You want to create your own large language model or whatever, because, you know, that's the new emerging technology, and you think you've got some good ideas, and you want to do that.
Yeah.
It's sort of, I find it very difficult to conceive of what you do on day one. You know, if you're simply buying in the expertise, say you raise money and you buy in the expertise, so you attract somebody who already knows how to do it. Mm. You say, come and work for me and we'll start doing it. It sort of seems to have that sort of regression problem of, well, who initially was the person who knew how to do it. But in a modern economy with technologies like this, that knowledge is, there never was just one person with all the knowledge. Mm. It's kind of emerged from the proximity of lots of different people with lots of different skills and knowledge bases that have managed to collaborate to create this new technology. And then it's almost like the mushroom what would you call it, where you split the mycelium and you regrow it out in two different places, you're cloning it again and again in different sort of environments, with London, Paris, you know, San Francisco, whatever. But where it initially emerged, it's what I find quite disconcerting about a modern economy is that there is no one person who sort of, as it were, invented AI. And so no one individual really understands or has the knowledge in their head, all of the knowledge that you would need to rebuild it from scratch.
What was the name of that mathematician who was the last guy who knew all the maths?
Wasn't it in the sort of the late 1700s or something?
Yeah. Then since then, no one individual has known all the maths.
Yeah.
It's a bit like that, I think.
It is like that, and I personally find that quite disconcerting, because it immediately seems to suggest that the fragility of things, looked at one way.
Well, I mean, software is extremely fragile, because again, it used to be, if you were starting a startup, you'd buy your own servers, you'd have your own team maintaining those servers. Mm. Whilst now, you just pay AWS a monthly subscription and you're on their servers, and you don't have to think about servers.
Yeah.
It's just not something you think about.
Yeah.
Which is far more efficient and cheap, but obviously you're relying on AWS.
Yeah.
Like, the entire internet basically relies on Amazon not messing up.
Yeah. And I was thinking about this watching, I was watching Masters of the Air, you know, the thing, the most recent iteration of Band of Brothers. And there's a scene where they're in the a prisoner of war camp and they've got a radio. They've managed to make a sort of rig together a radio so that they can get information from outside. And then the Germans find their radio, so it's confiscated. And one of the stars who's a prisoner says, "Oh, you know what? I used to make radios as a boy. A sort of, you know, graphite. All I need is a paperclip and some graphite and a sort of coil of wire, and I'm going to make a radio." Now, you know, I'm sure there are many people, of course, in the modern world who would be able to do that because they've studied that and they're interested in it. But I wonder, you know, the average person would have no idea how to do that because it's not something you need to think about. The technology is so established that, you know, it's not something that modern sort of boys, teenagers, girls, whatever, do in their spare time.
Yeah, it's not interesting anymore. It was really interesting in the 60s. You have all the nerds were, doing the electronics projects.
It's like nobody fixes their car anymore.
Yeah.
Because the technology is too complex with all the computers and stuff.
Yeah, you can't anymore.
But also people just aren't interested in it. It's not interesting.
There's no value add.
There's no value add, and because that's not, you know, back in the day, in the 60s, it was a massive benefit if you could fix your own car. Mm. Because A, it was fixable, probably, and B, it would, you know, there's not a mechanic, you know, always 5 minutes down the road or whatever. Mm. So I sort of...
Man, they went wrong all the time, so you needed to.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's something, I don't know, maybe this is an illusion, but I think that there's something that is, I don't know, countercultural or against the grain of the direction of the modern economy in learning how to do something yourself from scratch, all the way through the process, from sort of ground zero to the product, that is, as I say, a little bit... contrarian, a little bit countercultural, but quite rich and rewarding.
Extremely, and it's interesting to use the word countercultural because a lot of these techniques were developed by people trying to grow psychedelic mushrooms in the 60s.
Right.
Like the blueprint I'm using for growing lion's mane is based on these legal setups for growing psychedelic mushrooms, where it had to be kind of DIY and artisanal and you own the whole process because it was illegal.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was almost out of necessity
that
it became like this. And so, as a result, for some reason, the whole mushroom-growing scene has this DIY, hands-on, artisanal ethos.
Mm.
Even, you know, decent-scale commercial producers.
And do you think there's something slightly more... I hesitate to use this word because it's so nebulous, but is there something slightly more human about it than... you know, mastering a process from start to end? Is it more fulfilling? Is it more satisfying?
It's extremely satisfying, yeah.
Yeah. Does it give you more satisfaction than, say, I mean, you're very much a member of the modern economy, working how you do, you know, that your job, which you do day to day, is very much being a small
cog in a large machine.
A small cog in a bafflingly large machine, where it's very difficult to actually conceive of how the value that you are producing sort of inputs and outputs.
I have no way of... Yeah, back when I was a pot washer in a pub, you know, you start your shift with a bunch of dirty plates and you end it clean and you can see the value.
Yeah.
My current job, if someone asks me to defend why I'm getting paid to do this, it's like, I'd have a very hard time justifying.
Yeah.
The value I've created.
Yeah. And I think if I were to kind of take a risk and make a claim that I don't have the actual evidence for, I would say that probably people who find satisfaction in their jobs, most of them are going to be people where their job is closer to, in terms of the way it's structured and input and output is sort of works, is closer to pot washer than it is to, you know, what you do, you know, working with accounts and spreadsheets and that kind of thing. I would go out on a limb and say...
I think you're right, yeah. Because, you can have... Yeah, if you're, you know, a private equity investor, for example, you do see, you know, you buy a company, you make it better, you sell it. That is the same cycle as the pot wash.
Yeah, it's tangible.
And people find it very satisfying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Food for thought. So there's an insight there into, hopefully into something maybe about the slight malaise, moral malaise that we all experience as part of a modern economy.
Disconnection from reality.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's become so specialised that it's almost abstract to us as individuals.
Yeah, we don't see the whole.
It's happening at a scale that is above our scale.
Yeah.
And so it's quite difficult to hold on to the meaning of what we're doing sometimes.
Yeah.
Mm. Maybe that's a good place to end.
It is.
Yeah. Until next time, goodbye.
I'll go and eat some more mushrooms.
Yeah.